Welcome to the service of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of New Haven, which has been a home for liberal religion since 1836. That means we're open to new perspectives. If you're here for the first time, you can there's something you can sign up there to get, receive a newsletter. And so let's take a moment to greet each other. Our opening words are from Pascal, great 17th century mathematician and, shall we say, lay theologian. The eternal silence of those infinite outer spaces fills me with dread. Next, we have a poem by Carl Sandburg that you may know as the Booster of Chicago. This one here doesn't quite fall into his usual boosterism. Four preludes on playthings of the wind. The past is a bucket of ashes.
The woman named Tomorrow sits with a hairpin in her teeth and takes her time and does her hair the way she wants it, and fastens at last the last braid and coil, and puts the hairpin where it belongs, and turns and drawls, "Well, what of it? My grandmother yesterday is gone. What of it? Let the dead be dead."
The doors were cedar and the panel strips of gold, and the girls were golden girls, and the panels red and the girls chanted, "We are the greatest city and the greatest nation. Nothing like us ever was." The doors are twisted on broken hinges. Sheets of rain swish through on the wind. Where the golden girls ran and the panels read, "We are the greatest city, the greatest nation. Nothing like us ever was."
It has happened before. Strong men put up a city and got a nation together, and paid singers to sing and women to warble, "We are the greatest city, the greatest nation, nothing like us ever was." And while the singers sang and the strong men listened and paid the singers well, there were rats and lizards who listened, and the only listeners left now are the rats and the lizards. And there are black crows crying, "Caw, caw," bringing mud and sticks, building a nest over the words carved on the doors where the panels were cedar and the strips on the panels were gold. And the golden girls came singing, "We are the greatest city, the greatest nation. Nothing like us ever was." The only singers now are crows crying, "Caw, caw." And the sheets of rain whine in the wind and doorways. And the only listeners now are the rats and the lizards.
The feet of the rats scribble on the door sills. And the hieroglyphs of the rat footprints chatter the pedigrees of the rats. The babble of the blood and the gabble of the breed of the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers of the rats. And the wind shifts, and the dust on the door sill shifts, and even the writing of the rat footprints tells us nothing, nothing at all, about the greatest city, the greatest nation, where the strong men listen and the women warble, "Nothing like us ever was." Here's a poem by Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet, and this is a version based on translations by Robert Bly and Stephen Mitchell. "Exposed, left to die on the mountains of the heart. Look how tiny it is, do you see? The last village of language, and above it still tiny, one final granary of feeling. You've seen it before? Left out to die on the mountains of the heart. Stone ground under your hands. True, something blooms even here. An ignorant sprig blossoms out singing from the dumb mountain steep. But the human being of consciousness, he began to be aware and then fell silent, exposed, and left to die on the heart mountains. Many goats and deer go here, their knowing hole. Many short-footed mountain animals linger here or pass to other grassy places. And the big protected bird of prey circles around the pure refusal of the peaks. But not protected, not sheltered or cared for, here on the mountains of the heart. And we have a reading from Nietzsche, who actually was a great inspiration of Rilke.
He gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon. What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Where is it moving to now? Where are we moving to? Away from all suns? Are we not continually falling? And backwards, sidewards, forwards, in all directions? Is there still an up and a down? Aren't we straying as though through an infinite nothing? Isn't empty space breathing at us? Hasn't it got cold?
My talk is titled After Atheism, A Poem for the Heart. And you'll see that after atheism means something like after the death of God, as an event that happened in history, whether people are on board as atheists or not. We're drowning in the limitless. We are by nature, though, cave dwellers and house builders. We long for shelter, homeless in a restless sea of circumstance. Our old house is falling down. The only help is to build anew. But do we have the necessary inspiration? I feel a need for new ceremonies of participation, a movement of hope for an emergent new order. I cannot find a home in the older idealism of our culture, which always seems to locate true being and true life elsewhere. Could knowledge be based in sound? Sound immersion, as opposed to the one-point perspectivism of knowledge based in vision, which is our dominant idea of knowledge. Knowledge is something you can have from a distance. Inside the sphere, like the infant inside its mother's belly, sounds of the mother's body, her heartbeat, the mother singing, also sounds coming from outside, music, and singing from other sources, sounds of war and industry, all heard while still in the womb. Transformative immersion as the model for world change, as opposed to detached manipulation. In a time grown old in existing methodologies, a time of rigid orthodoxies, prescribing endless novelties, but all out of the same repetitive mechanisms. Overwhelming change, but always only more of the same. Pocketa, pocketa, pocketa. Always only extending the established direction of change. The dominant human group seems to suffer from an obsessive compulsive disorder. In our museum without walls, our broken container of can-do optimism, we discover an answer to the psalmist's question, what is man? Man is the prodigious builder, not just of pyramids and skyscrapers, of the Grand Coulee Dam and of the Three Gorges Dam, not just of vast cities and continent-spanning highway systems, but of all-encompassing spheres of life, the giant bubbles of culture. We know today of about 5,000 different cultures in America. Today, we also know that they are all fictions. They are collective fabrications that just grew without an architect. The fundamentalists have a solution to the disorienting experience of change in relativism. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Or Marx said it, I believe it, that settles it. Or even science said it. But, science says so many things. Or the true blue American says, progress, progress über alles. We have found the key to the good life, not just for ourselves, but for all people on earth. Better things for better living through chemistry. And we're willing to share. Haven't we been the true believers of this faith and progress? Looking at all the vast array of historical cultures, we have said with full confidence, we will bury you all. We will be the last man standing. And everyone who sees us will say, here come the Yanks, hurrah! Now, just lately, we have experienced a bit of doubt for the first time. What if progress is burying us? As we ransack the planet for the last of the oil, coal, uranium, copper, hydroelectric sites, you name it, we are bringing into being a planet stripped bare by none other than ourselves, the true believers and fundamentalists of progress. Isn't progress but one more fiction? One more bubble? Pop! There it goes. Our only choice now, needing shelter as we do, is to imagine a new fiction. To blow yet another bubble. Now we recognize that our knowledge is limited and we must steer our course by the light of imagined worlds. Let us create the new fantasy of reality that will heal the world. In full knowledge that we are constructing, we are creators, not mere recorders of the world. Let us invent the healing fiction and live in it, knowing it is a fiction yet guided by the facts of life we derive from experience. This next time around, let's design with nature, not against her. Let's follow along with the grain of things. The greatest problem that will result from the end of growth, which many now predict, will be a spiritual problem. The house of progress, our shelter and spiritual home, will be shaken to its foundations. Many will commit suicide as a result. This is called dying of exposure. So let's go back to the Nietzsche quote that Steve read. This comes from around a little more than 20 years after the publication of The Origin of Species. I believe that Nietzsche was very aware of Darwin, and that really Darwin is the one who wiped away the horizon, which he did by proposing that natural processes of the earth had brought the immense variety of life forms into being, including humans. The horizon had formerly been an act of God, a God outside and beyond nature. The ultimate horizon of our human being and awareness was an event, creation out of nothing, by God, the maker of heaven and earth. To this, Darwin says, implicitly, there is no need for that hypothesis, because the earth itself is a creative engine which has produced the myriad creatures over an immense span of time, hundreds of millions of years, it turns out, leaving us Western people with a shattered identity. The Victorians were very upset, you know, about this. If we didn't come from a unique act of divine creation, then who the heck are we? How do we fit into the nature of things? What are we? And what exactly is our relation to the other life forms? Is the jungle our mother? What happens to ethics? The norms of behavior we have derived from the assumption that we are not essentially animals, that the animal body is a mere vehicle in which we are riding along, and that we are spirit beings attached to a body we know not how. That was the view of most educated people in the West around 1800. And they thought that the earth was about 6,000 years old. That was the background assumption at that time. We're talking about educated people here. You know, they never thought about it before, and it was just lying in the street, so they picked it up, and that's what they thought. So don't we then need to rethink everything? The assumption of a divine creator was, in fact, the key element that was holding our world together, the ultimate horizon of thought. Now, we need a horizon of thought and imagination in order to live. Otherwise, you're disoriented. So this has more than a theoretical relevance. So my argument runs, we created a divine technosphere as a shelter. Progress became the new de facto horizon of our life as humans, of our collective imagination. And non-Western peoples, too, began to be drawn into this progress story. It was the terror of those eternal silent spaces, remember Pascal at the beginning, of a universe indifferent to humans that drove us to take up the role of the creator ourselves. The human being makes a new world and even creates itself in a sense, since our new technosphere reacts back upon us and expresses our new identity. No longer are we the creatures of God. We are the product not only of natural biological evolution, but also of the forces of cultural creation, which we have set in motion ourselves, but which, like the sorcerer's apprentice, we cannot turn off or control. My argument here is that the fundamental driving force of the modern world is not a simple and ultimately benign desire for practical improvements, such as the automatic clothes washer, but rather a terrible void, an infinite horizon. This void, the infinite universe, has given birth to us, the creators of the technosphere. We cannot tolerate the infinite void revealed to us by science. We are not well adapted to swim in an infinite ocean. We become very anxious animals in that milieu. Therefore, we have created the bubble of progress of technological civilization. And we're running it into the ground. We require a smaller world. Now, of course, the technological world is a very big one, but not compared to the universe. We require a smaller world, a world that we think, since we have made it, we can control or manage. We are like fish out of water creating our own aquarium, our artificial container, which we now take to be ultimate. Raw terror powers the modern explosion of knowledge and technique and is the source of its demonic-driven quality. But this new bubble we have blown in our desperate need for shelter is now in a state of crisis. It turns out that there is still an outside. The bubble is still within the infinite and mysterious and apparently cold, indifferent universe. Don't you feel a draft? Technology requires fuel. Peak oil is not just a technical subject, it is a very philosophical subject. Can you think of a device which creates its own energy supply literally out of nothing? No. The technosphere is dependent on supplies of energy and raw materials that come from outside itself. We are at the critical moment when the bubble pops. We are at the present time undergoing a new turning point similar to the one provoked by Darwin. As Darwin wiped away the horizon of a supernatural creator, so today the emerging fact of material limits to growth, limits imposed by a finite earth, wipes away the substitute horizon of progress, our de facto religion. Resistance to the ideas of peak oil and climate change comes ultimately from the anxiety of disorientation due to this loss of horizon. I mean, you just feel like you're being sucked, you know, into this void. Once again, we are naked, like a snail without a shell to protect it. It's time to get our bubble-blowing apparatus going again. We cannot tolerate such nakedness. We are dying of cold. We are flailing about, trying to keep our old bubble inflated, but it isn't working. There's a hole somewhere. The bubble's leaking. Our familiar world is collapsing. I believe that bioregionalism provides a solution, a new answer to the question, what is man? We are dwellers in the land. residents on the earth. We pick up a piece left lying on the ground after the breakup of the old religious system, like an artist picking up a piece of a mosaic broken and destroyed in war or earthquake, and then using it in his new composition. We are earth creatures. The Hebrew word Adam can be translated as earth creature. Adam, earth creature. But now in the context of a creative universe, a creative earth, it's time to dry our tears and face our fears and make the best of our situation as we actually know it. We artists, we earth creatures. The technosphere cannot serve any longer as our protective shell to shut out the reality of our place on earth. Instead of terror in a cold and indifferent world, we must find in our hearts the ability to love the earth and to feel that we are a part of it, that we can be at home here. Love and knowledge and know-how will create the new life-supporting and protective bubble, the home, the nest. Knowledge alone cannot do it. The earth-human dyad or partnership will be the new protective sphere. We will reimagine the earth as a warm, protective enclosure and room, a friendly earth, an earth well disposed to our humans. Someone will say, nature is cruel. Yes, but check out the humans. Doesn't the earth reflect back to us our own attitudes? Ruthless exploitation has been the norm of the modern world. Within the infinite universe, the earth is our home, or rather the earth is created as our home by our love. It was cold until now because we related it to it with cold-blooded detachment and objectifying rationality. It is up to us to endow the earth, to discover the earth as the nurturing sphere of our lives. Willfully, we modern people sought to dominate and control, handling our fear of the great void in that way. Our mastery and control would save us, so we thought. Now the only way left is to embrace the earth and accept ourselves as earth creatures, rather than continuing our vain pretension to be from elsewhere. Our destiny lies not beyond the stars, both as our old otherworldly religion maintained and as our new fundamentalist dream of salvation through technology continues by other means. In other words, when the earth is used up, we will rocket into outer space where we imagine other planetary possibilities await us. Instead of being the main character of God in the history of God with man, the salvation history, we took up the central role in the progress story. Anthropocentrism, by other means, is still anthropocentrism. You see what I'm saying is there's a sort of drifting along where you unconsciously are continuing part of the same mentality that you grew up in. You think you've left it behind, but in fact, one of your fundamental preconceptions about the role in the world actually derives from this story, a religious story that you feel you left behind. So the real story is, no, home is here. Here is where we belong. Earthly love is best. And we can aspire to be plain citizens of the land rather than lordly dominators. So the message is, be not afraid. Love the earth. Home is here. Correct your attitude. Only by taking up an attitude of gratitude toward the earth and accepting our role as finite living beings, residents on the earth, can we transform our situation from one of desperate alienation to one of at-homeness. We can recreate our image of the earth so that it will become that home for the heart which we so desperately require. Instead of an attitude of anger and resentment, because you are not the prince or princess of being, of all being, you have been led to believe that you were. That is, that the whole universe is but a stage and backdrop for you and your doings. Humans as the end and goal of the whole universe. An astounding piece of species narcissism. You are feeling a little resentful at having lost this status. If I can't be the king of the universe, then I just want to pull the whole house down. If my just and rightful place as lord of the earth and the veritable goal and purpose of the earth is denied me, then I say, let's push the button. Let's drop the big one. I believe that this attitude of despair and resentment has driven our whole modern project. We are a pissed off species. Or at least this is true of the more privileged specimens. Our whole civilizational project, construction of the current technospheric bubble, flows from the same sort of attitude we see in the resentful white males who provide the backbone of the religious right. We the hostile, we the resentful, we the disenfranchised, victims of a conspiracy to take away our status as the chief end of the universe. The last men of whom Nietzsche warned have come. The spoiled brats of the cosmos who want their candy now or else. The super consumers who refuse to renegotiate their way of life with the earth, which has given us everything. Instead of this resentment, an attitude of gratitude. Gratitude because you've seen the sun. You are a participant in the great happening illimitably earth. And the earth is enough. And earthly love is best. The earth transformed by human imagination. This is the house of being and our new home for the heart. I say the way of gratitude is the road less traveled. While the broad way that leads to destruction is the way of resentment. Resentment of the human condition. That's the daily bread of the last men, which we must resolutely refuse to eat. Bioregionalism is a new cosmopolitanism. It's not going back to small town, small-mindedness, you know exactly. A new cosmopolitanism, in each place we will build a local expression of the new worldwide culture. The Quinnipiac bioregion is our place of connection to the living earth. You could think of it that way. I was going to get the map out and I forgot. But, you know, we laid out a bioregion based on the location of the area where the Quinnipiac Indians live. Kind of goes up along the ridge on the over toward Guilford, and then it goes across the Hanging Hills, and then it comes back down through Westrock. So the Quinnipiac bioregion is our place of connection to the living earth, and you could think of it that way if you want to. Our life place is small enough to feel like a home, and yet it is a part of the greater earth. Walking the watersheds and the woods and the streets of our life place is a sacramental grounding in the earth that gave us life and sustains us among the living. Obtaining a yield of food from our home ground also expresses our love of and dependence upon our bioregion. To sing our connection is to know where we are, who we are, and where we fit into the larger scheme of things. Instead of resentment, gratitude. Instead of bitterness, delight in being alive here and now. Instead of alienation, acceptance. Instead of cold and lonely exposure on the mountains of the heart, the shelter of an earth we are actively reimagining and recreating as a home. Instead of cold exploitation of a planet we imagine as but a pile of raw materials, let love the earth be our watchword and the seed of a new culture that will shelter us. What I'm trying to do is make a distinction between the earth as such, as a neutral fact or collection of facts, and the earth as a partner and ally of humans. The objective earth is not the nest we require. We don't really, there's some question as to what exactly the objective earth is. That we always bring attitudes and feelings to our thinking about the earth. In fact, I would ask the question, could it be that objectivity itself is a form of emotional coldness on our side? To build a nest on earth with the materials the earth offers, this is not narcissism. This is partnership with the given. This is adapting to the earth in each place, as opposed to changing the earth to suit our desire to be Lord and Master. Our home from the heart, our shelter from the great chill of atheism, will be this partnership with ourselves as but one half of the earth-human dyad. Let's see. Okay.
have a question.
Just hold this a second.
Okay.
Before we do that, I would like you to join me in a little chant, which I think you'll find very easy. Let's see. Should we stand up? Get the circulation back. Home is here, Quinnipiac land. 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 Okay, let's stop there. You could see how you could do this as a call and response. You could also do it as a round so that you have the whole phrases overlapping each other all the way through. And the closing words are from Robert Frost. Earth's the best place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better.